Okay, with all of that behind us now, I'd like to welcome our speaker this evening, Marilyn N., 19 years of fresh.
Marilyn, I'm an alcoholic. I never practice for these things because every time I do, nothing comes out like I practiced it. So I didn't even really think about it because it's true. And I'm trying to figure out where I should start from. I'm going to start from 5 years old because it just pisses off John Cody. Whenever he hears me talk about this, he doesn't believe me. But when I was 5 years old, we lived in the country on the outskirts of Bakersfield. And my dad was a farmhand or whatever you call it. And every day at lunchtime, I would drive the car. Mind you, this is a three-speed on the column. And I would drive it down into the field to take my dad his lunch, which consisted of a few beers and a sandwich. And while I sat there, he let me drink some of his beer, you know, and I never thought anything about it. It was just, you know, back in those days, that was a long, long time ago. And people, you know, I didn't think anything about that, did not think it was wrong, didn't think anything, you know, until I went to school and some of my old friends started asking me to come and spend the night with them in town, in the big town, you know. And I saw that their parents weren't like my parents. They didn't drink. They went to church on Sunday. And they were just functional, you know. And my parents were totally dysfunctional. And so I started wondering, you know, well, what was wrong with my parents? And as time went on, my dad was a bad alcoholic, and he was a mean one. When he got drunk, he beat my mother, and he did a lot of things. And I could not wait to leave home. I just could not wait. And my thoughts were, I was never going to marry an alcoholic, and that's what I did. I grew up, actually, I wasn't grown up. I was 16 when I got married. And I married an alcoholic. And then I started having little alcoholics of my own. And I had three of them. And two of them are alcoholic. And the other one is chocoholic, foodaholic, whatever you want to call it. And he's the one that goes to this school. This place is very special to me, to my heart, because my son goes here, and he's my oldest son, and he was born with Down syndrome. And his pictures are all over the place here, and usually he has some kind of art or some kind of pottery or something going on here. And so that was one of the reasons I accepted to talk tonight, because of this place and what it's done for my son's life. Anyway, so when I married the first time, he was alcoholic and I wasn't. And after about 8 years of marriage, I left him and I turned into an alcoholic. I don't know how that happened, but it just did, you know. And I said I was never going to get married again. I was just going to party, party, party. And that's what I did. That's what I did until I met my second husband. And this is kind of a weird thing. It's kind of funny to me, I think. When I met my first husband, most of you guys know who he is, and I'm not going to say his name. But I met him at church. When I met my second husband, I met him in a bar. Go figure, you know? And he was not a bartender at that time, but he became one. And I remember he had this silver Dodge Charger, and I had a gold Dodge Charger. And on the back of that Charger, I put, I had a little thingy on there that says, respect your bartender. So I married because I free drinks for life, you know. And after a few years, he hated the bar business. He hated drunks, and you know, I don't blame him because he was not a drunk. And so I don't know where I crossed over that line into alcoholism, but I did. And he, God bless him. He stayed with me through all the stuff, you know. And I did other things besides alcohol. And for a lot of years, probably about 12 years, I drank alcoholically and got into a lot of stuff and felt totally less than everybody, less than everybody. And I don't know if that's enough to make you drink or not, but it sure helped me. And whenever I was drinking, I wasn't less than anybody. And I was beautiful, and I was the life of the party, and went out drinking and dancing and having a good time. And in the end, I was not dancing and having a good time. I was all dressed up and went to my kitchen table as far as I got, you know. Did not have any companions, and by then, it was the end of my drinking. And I sat around the kitchen table and by myself. And my kids will tell you, I would sit there with this trivia. In those days, Trivial Pursuit was the end thing to do. And so I sat around and I memorized the card so when my girlfriends came over, I could beat them. You know, and needless to say, I couldn't remember what I was trying to memorize for 2 minutes. But I just did not want to go out anymore because I got in trouble when I went out, you know. And I got to feeling so bad about myself. Nobody can beat you up like you can beat yourself up. Oh, my God, I could beat myself up so bad. And my husband got to the point where he just didn't say anything to me because I was hurting. I was just hurting so bad. And came to a point where I couldn't drive the car. I could drive it, but he wouldn't let me. He wouldn't let me because he was scared to death I was going to get thrown in jail. And I don't know how I missed out on that. I really don't know how. right over here is the depot. And then on down the road, I can't remember what that was called then, but it's the Cadillac Club, or was it Cadillac Club? I don't remember what it was called then. But anyway, I was there one night, and it was 2 o'clock and closing time, and you got to go somewhere, you know? And so I was going to hurry up and get back to the depot because I knew the cocktail waitress there, and I was going to get another drink, you know? And so instead of going the regular route, I went down a one-way street the wrong way. And I pulled into the depot along with 2 cop cars, lights on everywhere, and, you know, I thought it was funny. I mean, I thought it was very amusing, you know. And so I pulled in, and they got me out of the car and had me doing the drunk test, all this crap, you know. And I was making all kinds of excuses as I was laughing. I'm laughing, and I'm like, you see these shoes? Why don't you try doing that in these shoes? And so they said, we'll take them off. So I took them off, and I don't know what the problem was after that, but I failed miserably, and they gave me every chance in the world, you know? And so finally they put the bracelets on, and I said, no, wait. I'm not going anywhere without my purse. And they said, well, okay, we'll go get your purse. And I happened to think of what I had in my purse at that point. I went, oh, no, I really don't need it. No, I don't need it. And thank God they didn't get that. But so they had the bracelets on, and they were getting ready to call it in and putting me in the back seat of the car. And my friend, the cocktail waitress in the depot, she comes strolling out, and she sees me and Dan, and she's like, oh, please don't take her. I'll take her home. Please don't take her. And they didn't. You know? That happened to me so many times. You know, one time it was, I had a gun. A .22 automatic, and it was under the front seat. And it was my husband's car, and I got stopped on the freeway, 198, coming in. And they got me out of the car and did all this crap like they did before. And there was a guy and another girl in the car with me, and they got the guy out of the car. He was on the passenger side. Well, as they had me out, they were shining the flashlight in the car, and he pulls out the gun. He said, "What's this?" And I said, "Well, it looks like a gun to me." And he said, "Is it yours?" And I said, "No, it's not mine. It's not even my car. You know, it's some guy I know. It's his car." Well, you know, the only thing that saved me on that one was the chamber was empty. The first chamber was empty. The rest of them were full. And so he let me go. He didn't let me drive, but he let the guy that was with me drive, you know. So got out of that one. And, you know, in the early days of my drinking and stuff was when I was still married to my first husband. And I would party in Tulare, which is where we live. And I knew all the cops. All the cops. I partied with them. So they never gave me a ticket. And I used to chase my husband all over town, you know, trying to get him to either give me the paycheck or do something. I don't know what it was I was trying to get him to do, and he never did any of it. And so one night I was chasing him, and the red and blues were on behind me, and they pulled both me and him over. And they wanted to take him to jail because he was drunk. But they came back to my car and they said, "We can't take him without taking you too." And I said, "Well, you just probably better let him off the hook this time then, because I don't want to go to jail." You know, and so that happened. And it was so lax in those days. You know, this was back in the 60s. Everything was just lax, you know. And we got away with a lot of stuff. And I remember some of the times, I wasn't alcoholic then, but I was crazy. I was Al-Anon, you know. I was the enabler. Enabled him to do all these things, you know. And he would make me so damn mad. And I remember one night I went downtown, and there was a bar downtown called The Cellar. It was downstairs in The Cellar. And I went down there, and I was throwing things at David and just, you know, acting crazy because he wouldn't come home. He was drunk, and I couldn't get any money. And so he came upstairs, followed me upstairs, and I got in my car, and I told him to get the hell out of the way. He didn't. And I ran over him. And so I told him... It's in the top thing. Just open it and shut it. Sorry, I forgot, you guys. So anyway, I ran over him, and I'm sure it just grazed him or whatever. But he was down, you know. And I told him, I said, you know, out the car window, I said, "You better not get up." And he got up. Ran over him again. And I thought about that later. That's just one of those crazy things that I did. And I'm sober. I'm cold sober. But I told him, you know, he infuriated me. And so, my life, that's how my life was with him. You know, and one time I went down this, on South K Street, and there was this place called, no, that wasn't the Heidi Hole. I don't remember what it was called. Anyway, he had been screwing around with this girl. And so, yeah. And so I went down there, and she was a go-go dancer. This tell you kind of like what age it was, you know? She's a go-go dancer. And she's in this cage, and she's doing all this. Well, she saw me walk in the front door, and she knew. She knew why I was there. And I went up and I grabbed her leg through the stage scene, you know, and I told her, I said, come out of there now. Well, she wouldn't do it. So the lady owner named Jolene, I mean, God, I think there was a song about Jolene, country song. And she comes out from behind the bar and she says, you better leave now. I said, I'm not going anywhere. She pulled this gun out of her purse and she said, I think you are. And I said, I don't think so. You know, you're going to have to pull that trigger. I was crazy. I'm telling you, I was nuts. Didn't have any booze in me. Well, she didn't pull the trigger, and obviously I left. But that's just some of the stupid things. When I was 19, when I was 19 years old, I'm down at the place in Tulare. I don't know what it's called then. Cozy Inn, Shiloh. I mean, one of the nicer places in town, you know. I was there with some girlfriends, and my ex-husband, when the band was on break, he went up to where the microphone was, and he let everybody know that there's this B word, I'm not going to say, I probably know what it is, sitting over there at that table. And then he walks over to that table where I'm sitting, and he looks at me. And I had a beer. I don't know why I had a beer. I don't even like beer. But it was a bottle. And I picked it up, and my lady's face opened. He still has a scar, and he'll tell you about that himself, I'm quite sure. But they made him leave. Blood squirting everywhere, you know. They made him leave. And that's the kind of life I led before I ever became an alcoholic. And things were pretty mild after that, you know. Anyway, when I married my second husband, he's so normal. He was so normal, it was boring, you know. Every once in a while, well, he would go out with me, and I could tell when he was getting to be a little tipsy, he didn't like that. He did not like being out of control. And he would say, I'm ready to go home now. And I never was ready to go home. But I knew when he was, and I could almost tell you, 5 cocktails would be the limit for him. And he would leave, and I would stay, and that's how it always went with us. You know? And I love to drink, and I love to go, after the bars are closed, I love to go somewhere and continue to drink until the sun came up. And, you know, when that sun comes up, it does something to you. You know, it's like, man, I'm in big trouble now. Big trouble. You know, and I always said that to myself, you know. Well, 1 o'clock in the morning would come, and I'd think, you know what, it's too late to go home now. He's already sick. I mean, he's already mad at me. So 2 o'clock comes, and I'm like, okay, somebody's going to have a party because I cannot go home now. But I thought I could go home when the sun came up and everything would be okay for some reason. I don't know why I thought that, but it never was okay. And what I did was not okay with my husband, and it really became not okay with me, you know. And I look back on some of the things that I used to do, and it actually makes me die half sick. I cannot believe that I would do some of the things that I did. And I ended up drinking with my kids, something I said I would never do. And they were like, I don't know, 17. They were 17, 18, I don't know. But I ended up drinking with them, and I hated that because I never wanted to do that. And I remember one time my son, my youngest twin, he would call me on the telephone and he would say, Mom, I know you're up. It'd be like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I'd say, yeah. And your point? Well, you're going to lose Nick. If you don't stop this, you're going to lose him. And I said, well, you know what? You're the one that's got the problem. Where are you? You know? You always lay it off on somebody else. It's always someone else's fault. Never my own. Never. You know? And finally, I started looking at myself and seeing what I was doing. And I needed to not do that anymore. because it hurt me too much to the guilt. The guilt just chilled me. So finally, I had had enough. And the only one I knew was in recovery was my ex-husband, and I didn't want to call him, you know. And the other person I knew was Mr. Manson over here. And I called him on the telephone one morning. I don't know if it was morning or not. Hell, I don't know. I've been gone for 2 days. And called my husband one more time to come and pick me up. And one more time, I saw the look on his face. And I know you guys know that look. And it's like, oh, if I could have crawled in a hole and died, I would have done it. And that's actually what I thought about that day, was I'm done. I am done. I'm going to have to kill myself because I can't do this anymore. And that, I was looking in the mirror when I'm telling myself this stuff. Look at you. Look at what you have became. You know, and for once, I didn't think I was that cute. What I really saw was what was really there. And it was nothing. It was this little bit of a woman, 85 pounds of nothing, with this leather-looking skin because I had to drink water, and I mean, alcohol is not the same as water, I found out. No matter how much alcohol you drink, you need water. And I looked really, really bad, and I wanted to die. And I thought, you know what, I think I'm probably going to just have to take myself out because I'm not good for anybody, most of all me. So I called Charlie, because I knew, I partied with Charlie a lot, and I knew how bad he was. And I had heard he was sober. So I called him, and he was at my house in about 10 minutes. And he comes walking down the hall, and he takes one look at me, and he said, "What are we going to do about this?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know, but I can't do this anymore." And he said, "Well, we need to maybe get you into a recovery place." And I said, "If I had any money, Charlie, that might be one thing, but all my money went, you know, where?" And so recovery place is out of the question. So he said, "Okay, I will take you to a meeting." And he was supposed to come over that night and take me to a meeting. Well, no, we went downtown first to talk to a counselor somewhere. And it was suggested that I go to meetings. And so he was going to take me to a meeting that night, but I finally crashed. You know, I'd been up for days. And I finally crashed, and my husband couldn't wait me up to go to this meeting. And so I thought to myself, the next morning I thought, what I was afraid of was I was going to be wake up the next morning and have made a mistake. You know, I'm really not that bad. And I really don't need to do this or don't need to do that. It's really not that bad. Quite sure some of you have felt that way. And, but I didn't feel that way when I woke up. I knew how bad it really was. And so he did come and take me to my first meeting. And I will never forget that meeting. It was a birthday meeting, and it was over 100 years of sobriety at that meeting. And it was awesome. And I remember him telling me on the way that the worst thing about all this was when you find out you can never have another drink again. And I said, "No way." No, there's got to be a different way here. But that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to learn how to drink like a lady and go home after a couple. Because that's what I always said. I'm going to go have a couple drinks with my friends. Never was a couple, ever, you know? And when I learned that, I just about went back out, you know? But thank God they had this saying, one day at a time. And I thought, you know what? I can do one day at a time. You just wake up every morning and it's another day. And you do it again, and you do it again. But it was all I could do to get through a minute. Those first months were real rocky. But somewhere along the way there, I got really well. And at 5 months and 2 days sober, I came back in with my tail between my legs, and I went out. I had gone out for one night, and it was pretty weenie type thing, you know. But I knew when I picked up that first drink that night, I knew I can't do this. I cannot do this anymore. And so that's when I did the admitting to your innermost self that you're alcoholic. I would call it the step before the first step. If you don't feel it down here where you live, you're not going to get it. I'm sure you're not going to get it. You can do step one all you want to, but if you don't believe it, it's not going to work. So I came back after that one night, and I cried for months. I probably cried for 3 months after that. Every meeting I'd go to, I'd cry, you know, and I couldn't sleep. I just couldn't do anything. And after a while, it became clear to me that, you know what, you're going to either have to get on the program or get out of the program. So I got into it, and I got real serious about it. And I got a sponsor because my sponsor fired me because I got drunk. She fired me. Well, she was on my fourth step, by the way. So I got a sponsor that believed in me, and she told me, you can do it. We're going to do the steps. Boom, boom, boom. We're not going to mess around. We're not going to wait around. And in those days, I'd hear people say, you know, 4 years sober and hadn't done the fourth step, and I would be wondering, you know, well, how do you stay sober without doing the steps? And you can. You can, but you don't have anything I want. You know, a dry drunk is the most miserable drunk in the house, you know? You got no program, you got no nothing, you're just not picking it up. You're not drinking, and I wonder why. And if I didn't have a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here. Because that's one thing I love, is to have fun. I like to laugh, man. I like to have a good time, you know? And I got all this in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it has not been easy. Thank God, though, the desire to drink was lifted from me early on. I'm losing my voice here. And so I wasn't worried about drinking. It was a living problem then, and it still is today. I don't drink, don't want to drink. I don't think about drinking. Every once in a while it may flip through my mind, but it's just kind of, they're gone, you know. But the living things today are the hard part, you know. And I don't care how much time you get sober, you still are going to make mistakes. I still make mistakes, and I still have to clean up my mess. And I make amends to people. I have to get my own side of the street clean. You know, and I can't make amends expecting anything from them. Whether they owe me one or not, I can't expect it from them. It's all I can do, clean up my side and get on with the program. And it doesn't matter, like I said, how long, and you still get back into some resentment and stuff. Stuff still goes on, no matter how long you are sober. And so today, what I'm trying to do today is basically try and keep my mouth shut and not tick anybody off, because that seems to be the thing that, you know, happens to me the most. And I love my friends. I love my friends in recovery, you know. The women, most of the women in recovery are my friends, you know. And a lot of them are new friends, and a lot of them are old friends. Leanne and I have been together ever since day one. We came in together. I think I came in about 20 days. No, 10 days after her. And we've been friends ever since, you know? And then some other people that are here are my new friends meaning 3 or 4 years and, you know, a couple of years, whatever. You know, and to me, the women in the program are the ones that are going to save your butt. Not the men. Not the men. And I thoroughly believe men with men, women with women, you know. That's what I was told early on, you know. You don't get a man sponsor. A man doesn't know what goes on with a woman, you know. If they did, they'd probably still be married or whatever, you know. You just don't mix the two, you know. And that's okay, because I loved men when I got here. Actually, the women are the ones that scared me. I didn't like women. As far as I was concerned, they were all conniving, you know what, and which they really are, you know. And I have some men friends. I have men friends in this program. And I have some really good men friends early on. Now I only have a couple of men friends in the program. Well, I've got a few. Not as many as I used to have, because that's another story for another day. But anyway, the women are the ones that will help you, you know? I don't know. To me, the steps are where it's at in this program. And whether you do them slowly or quickly, you're going to get the relief if you do them, however it is you do them. And I don't know. I'm just going to stop now. What time is it? Oh, man, I got a lot of time left here. Anyway, you know, I really don't have a lot more to say other than, you know, just keep coming back. Just stay here so you don't have to come back. Just stay. Do the steps. Get a sponsor. Do the steps. Go to meetings. As my friend Don W. says, do the whole pie. You know, you can do a piece here and a piece there, but if you're missing a few pieces, then you don't get the full benefit of this program. What this program has to offer, you know? And I've done the whole pie, you know? And I get everything. And you give what you get. You can't give something that you don't have, you know? And that's one of the things in the program. It's the paradoxes. You know, you have to die in order to live. You have to give away. You can't keep what you don't give away. And you know, all these sayings are so stupid, but live, let live. When you are backed up where the rubber meets the road, you're going to remember the things that you hear. The sayings that we say all the time, you know? And I know that I did. I had a belly full of booze and a head full of AA, and I was like, that is the worst. There is no fun to be had whenever you're in that shape. So I thought, okay, if I can't have fun drinking anymore, then I got to really get with it here. And that's what I've done. I've made mistakes along the way. And you show me somebody that don't make mistakes, and I'll show you somebody that's not doing the same thing. Because that's what life is about, mistakes. And what you learn from those mistakes. And when you do keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, you're going to get the same thing. And one of the biggest things, if I could say one word that sums up the total of this program, it's change. Our resistance to change is where we get in trouble, you know. If you just go with the change, usually it's better than what you had expected anyway, you know. Anyway, that's about all I've got. And Bill says I can do questions and answers. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, thank you. We do have a few minutes, and at this time we'd like to ask you if you have any questions for the speaker, we welcome those. So that there will be more time to answer questions, we ask that you ask only questions and then some try to share a response. So
I'm still there, thank you. you guys did my chapter and it was cool for me. Maybe you could tell them something else that you had to walk through and that you didn't have sobriety and they not have to do it.
I can't believe I forgot that. I cannot believe that. When I was 7 years sober, sobriety was from 2 years to 7 years. Sobriety was piece of cake. The pink cloud, all this stuff, you know, that you hear about. That's where it was at for me. And at 7 years, I was diagnosed with breast cancer and stage two, which is not good, but it's not real bad either. And if it weren't for sobriety, I don't know. I would not have done what I did, you know. In order to save my own life, I did chemotherapy, I did radiation, I turned 50 and bald all in the same day, and life just doesn't get much worse than that. But, you know, it really did not bother me that much. It really didn't, because I mean, your hair can grow back. You know, you can't grow a new life. And thank God and this program, I made it through that, and it's been 10 years. 10 years of, maybe even longer than that. It was 1996. Yeah, it's been 12 years that I'm free of cancer, in remission, or whatever you want to say, you know. And I, like I said, without this program, I could not have done what I did. And I love this program. And it also taught me how to trust in God, not just have faith. I always had faith in God, but I wasn't, the trust thing just, you know, kind of like skate by for a while on it. But whenever I wasn't sure I was going to live or die, I put myself into God's hands, which I was already there, just didn't know it, you know, and I said, whatever you got going for me, just let me do this with dignity. And I think I did. I think I did. I had hats that I wore. I had a black hat and a white hat. And a leopard hat. However I felt for that day. I wore the white hat more than I did the black hat, so I felt pretty good most days. And I'll never forget, right before I was doing chemo, or maybe it was right after, I don't remember the sequence of it, but I got an infection because I had put polysporin on this little thing I had on my face, and my face swelled up like a balloon, and it was cracked and bleeding like a raw hamburger meat. I couldn't hardly even smile because I was so swollen. And I still went to meetings. I went to the Alano Club, and my friends kind of looked at me and turned away real quick. And others weren't sure whether to hug me or to say hi, because I looked like I had leprosy or something, you know. And if I could have laughed, I would have laughed, because to me it was so funny. My husband says, "You are not going out like that, are you?" And I said, "Stress, I am." You know, and I did, because I had no look good. And, you know, I've said this before, I'll say it again. You can't save your butt and your face at the same time. And so, you know, it was all about saving my butt. And your look good can kill you. And I know people in this program that have had that. And you know what? They don't stay sober. They don't stay sober. I like to look good, but it doesn't bother me when I don't, you know. I came to meetings every which way. I don't care. Just don't care. It's not all about whether you think I look good or not. It's about whether I am comfortable enough within my own skin. And today I am. Any more questions? Yes, they are. Pardon me? You bet. They follow me everywhere else. One of them is, you might know them, that Darren and Dale Looper. Well, no, they don't care. Dale's got 8 years sober, and the other one, I don't know. Not sure about him. Yes?
In the first 5 years of sobriety, actually had just 1 night.
And when I had 5 months and 2 days sober, I relapsed. For one night.
What about you relapse?
It could be anything. It could be anything. I don't know why I did it. Actually, I just went to a reunion, a class reunion, on a Saturday night, and everybody was drinking, having a good time, and I was kind of like not feeling great about that. I went home early, and 2 days later I relapsed, and I thought to myself, why couldn't I have done this on Saturday night? I could have fun with my friends. But, you know, I don't know why I did. Really, I don't. But I know that if you're totally working a program, it probably won't happen.
Yeah, you said that you were an alcoholic in your first marriage, and did you believe in your higher power, and has your recovery strengthened that relationship with your higher power? You know what I mean? Like, did you have faith at that time that you weren't an alcoholic? And now, then you went through becoming an alcoholic, and now, you know, if you did the higher power play a part in that?
Absolutely. No, I did not have a God of my own understanding at that point in time before I became an alcoholic. I drank, but I didn't drink alcoholically until a little bit later on. At one point, I was baptized, and that was early, after I had my children and stuff. I was baptized and I believed in God, but yet I don't know where I went wrong, but I did. And then when I got to this program, I found a God here, because the God I think I had was punishing. I thought, you know, I'm going to be punished big time for all the stuff I had done. And when I got here, I could believe that you believed. And that's all I needed to do at first, was just believe you believed. And then I came to believe. It's like step three. Step one, you came. Step two, you came too. Step three, you came to believe. And that's where it's all at. Those first three steps where it's all at. And every day, I turn my life and my will over to the care of God, as my understanding, which I call him God. You know, I don't know if he or she, don't care. But it's God. And whenever I start feeling a little bit away from that God, I start getting myself into trouble. You know, I don't relapse, but I do some relapse-type behaviors, you know. Anybody else? Okay.
What do you offer to lay as advice or suggestions for people who are struggling with this whole God concept and they come to recovery?
Basically, until you can come to believe there is a God, you can use my God. Whoever, you know, you get a sponsor, and that sponsor will probably tell you the same thing. You can use mine until you find one of your own. And you don't have to call it God. You don't. In the old days, they used to say, you know, you can, your higher power could be a pack of cigarettes, you know. I never kind of went for that one, you know. It's like, hey, you know. And I smoked in those days, and I'm looking at my pack of cigarettes, and I'm thinking, I don't really think this is going to work for me, you know. But, I could believe in something, because you go outside and you look at the universe, what you can see of it, the moon, the stars, it's like, that's a whole lot more powerful than I am. So right there is a greater power than myself. And that's all you have to do at first is just kind of believe that we believe, basically, until you come to your own belief. Wendy?
What would be any of us when you walk through life,
that's another thing, and I didn't talk about that either, and that's one of the most important parts of my recovery is when I lost my mother. I was, I think I was about 8 or 9 years sober, 10 maybe, I don't know, I can't remember. But I lost my mom, and that was the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with in my life, ever. Ever. Getting sober was easier than that, you know? And how I got through that, once again, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's another thing. When you have something going on in your life, we in AA have had the same things go on. You find someone that lost their mother, and you talk to them. And I've said this before, too. You know, I'm not going to go to a gynecologist when my toe hurts. And it's the same way in recovery. We go to somebody that has experienced the same thing we have. And we ask them, how did you get through that? And I did that. I will never forget. I did that. Well, I got through it crying, you know, and knowing that I was 10 years sober. I had 10 good years with my mother. I made amends to my mom. I had 10 great years with her. And in the end, I took care of her. I watched her die. I held her in my arms when she died. And there was no one in that room but me and her and God. Everyone else had stepped out for whatever reasons, and it was only me and her. And it was an experience, I think, that was beautiful. I hated it, but it was beautiful. Her passing was like, you know, well, she was drugged out on morphine, so it was pretty good for her, you know. Anyway, no, that was a hard thing, and I just had to go through it one step at a time. Am I done?
Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome.